From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week saw the first presidential debate and the ensuing debate over who won the first presidential debate, which, strictly speaking, is unanswerable. There is no panel of judges scoring on a point system. What isn't unanswerable is who the media say won the debate. And that one's easy. Factoring out a few outlier votes, Hillary Clinton trounced Donald Trump.
Point by point, she hit him on personal matters to get him to react. And in every case, he reacted.
For example, mentioning someone like Rosie O'Donnell in a presidential debate, never a good thing.
If there were an algorithm to determine who won, it might be something like number of memorable prepackaged zingers.
I call it trumped up. Trickle down, because that's exactly what it would be.
Minus volume of bodily function sounds, divided by moments of becoming unhinged along Captain Queeg lines.
Everybody refuses to call Sean Hannity. I had numerous conversations with Sean Hannity at Fox, and Sean Hannity said, and he called me the other day, and I spoke to him about it.
How the electorate processes 90 minutes of back and forth is always a mystery. Even the dial groups brought in by the cable channels are recording reactions to moments, not overall perceptions. And for the media, those moments are the commodity.
I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You mentioned the Navy, for example, and that we have fewer ships than we did in 1916. Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets.
The candidates, therefore, are heavily motivated to orchestrate gasp-worthy moments of, no, she didn't.
He called this woman Miss Piggy. Then he called her Miss Housekeeping because she was Latina. Donald, she has a name.
Where did you find
her? Her name is Alicia Machado.
Where did you find her?
And she has become a U.S. citizen, and you can bet she's going to vote this November.
Okay, good.
Now, this is the same debate in which Donald Trump bragged that he was smart for not paying taxes, admitted that he had rooted for the housing crisis, and suggested that we should run something resembling a protection racket on our allies. But this week in the media, it was all martyred beauty queen, all the time. Cosmopolitan magazine and The Guardian newspaper both rushed out in-progress pieces on Machado soon after the debate so as not to miss the Miss Piggy train. And you could hardly turn on the television without seeing the woman's face.
Joining me now, the former Miss Universe and now Hillary Clinton supporter.
And Alicia Machado joins me now.
I saw the interview that she did on the Today Show, so at least for the next couple of days, it's not going to go away.
The helpful intermediary offering up this most coveted guest for one-stop booking? Why? The Clinton campaign, as explained on CNN.
Anderson, this is very clearly a concerted effort and a very organized effort by the Clinton campaign to get Alicia Machado's story out there. They think it speaks to sexism. They think it speaks to racism.
For crying out loud, though the screen graphics said breaking news, the Machado story itself has been making the rounds for more than a year, from Jorge Ramos on Univision to the New York Times. The most charitable way to put it is the story had legs. Really nice legs. No, contrary to some Twitter speculation, there's no evidence of media collusion with the Clinton campaign, but that almost doesn't matter. What matters is that the Clinton strategists, maybe because they've carefully observed the whole Trump circus, did know exactly how the press would take the bait. It's a little creepy, it's distasteful, but mainly, it's just embarrassing. In an emergency meeting last week, the UN Security Council failed to halt Syria and Russia's bombing campaign of Aleppo, the graveyard of a city whose rubble and civilian death toll have made it synonymous with hopelessness in the Syrian civil war.
4 days of relentless Russian and Syrian bombing has led to a grisly sight. Hospitals are awash in the blood of civilians.
U.S. Ambassador to the UN Samantha Power blamed Russia for what's been called the most heinous act of the 5-year war, an attack on a humanitarian aid convoy in Aleppo on September 19th during a ceasefire. Despite eyewitness accounts, the Kremlin has denied responsibility for the attack on the convoy and subsequent bombings. Russia's shocking military support of Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria, at least in the media, now has a name.
The United States is accusing Russia of barbarism and war crimes in Syria.
The indiscriminate and systematic use of such arms on civilian areas constitute a war crime. Yes, a war crime.
You have said that you are pretty convinced the Russians attacked that aid convoy in which 20 aid workers were killed. If that isn't a war crime, what is it?
Well, Andrew, I think that is the right question to ask.
Yes, although the coverage so far has left little doubt as to the answer. Because the definition of war crime is not especially obscure.
When military commanders in the field use military force in a way that violates one of three principles.
David Sheffer is a former United States ambassador at large for war crimes issues.
One, military necessity. Two, the principle of proportionality. Are you using force to achieve your targeted military objective, or are you going way overboard with tons of collateral damage, etc.? And then finally, distinction. Are you actually distinguishing between the combatant enemy versus the civilian population?
Sheffer spoke with us from Nuremberg, where he is the closing speaker for the 70th anniversary commemoration of the Nuremberg trials.
Nuremberg set sort of the gold standard at the very beginning by literally listing certain war crimes, but we've seen a tremendous evolution in the law of war and in what we call international criminal law since World War II. If you look at the issue today with Syria and other conflict areas in the world, there's a much richer body of law to work with than they had at Nuremberg.
When the press is covering any of these events, it's sometimes uses almost interchangeably terms like war crimes, atrocities, even crimes against humanity. And I guess they're all not technically the same thing.
Crimes against humanity, that's a widespread or systematic assault on a civilian population with knowledge that you're actually doing it. You don't have to be in warfare for a crime against humanity. You're actually assaulting your own people. I think for journalists, it's much easier just to use the term atrocity crimes without trying to parse out what type of crime was it, because that's going to take years in tribunals to be certain about that. And the real issue should be not is it genocide or not, and should we react if it's not genocide or if it is genocide. The real issue should be we should be reacting because it is one of these types of crimes.
Much as the word terrorism has been opportunistically kind of expropriated by various people for propaganda purposes, ultimately diluting its impact, I wonder if the term war crimes is used too haphazardly, in your view, so as to muddy the waters of what's a war crime to begin with.
There may be something to that, where it's used too casually, too conveniently, without knowing really what has transpired on the ground that would constitute a war crime. Oftentimes you have to wait for courts to actually iron that out. Sure, you can have intelligence services that are bringing you reports every morning, etc. But I experienced this in my government service in the 1990s. Frankly, it is the press that oftentimes, if not most of the time, will bring you the earliest information, the most descriptive information about what is actually going on in the field. Without journalists who are brave enough to go out there and risk their lives, we would be, in many cases, quite blind.
I want to ask you about the very complex legal principle known as I'm rubber, you're glue, whatever you say bounces off of me and sticks to you. When British Foreign Minister Boris Johnson accused the Russians of a war crime in the attack on the aid convoy in Aleppo, the Russian foreign ministry came back and said, us, war criminals? No, the UK are the war criminals. Look what they did in Iraq. And suggesting that the United Kingdom has no moral authority to be making accusations like that?
If there's hypocrisy, it should be pointed out. But it is of total irrelevance to the determination of whether or not Russia committed a war crime when the humanitarian convoy was hit on September 19th. But there's a very good possibility that there will be no prosecution of Russian commanders with respect to what's taking place in Syria, because there's no international tribunal, either of a permanent character or a hybrid character, that has jurisdiction over Russia. Now, that's just a reality of where we are right now in the arc of justice, frankly.
And in the meantime, it takes the UN Security Council to authorize an investigation and a prosecution, but the Russians have veto power on the Security Council and therefore impunity.
When we started building the modern age of war crimes tribunals in 1993, no one predicted we would be where we are today with six major war crimes tribunals actively at work, bringing to date about 160 leaders to justice. And that includes presidents, prime ministers, etc., have been brought to justice by these war crimes tribunals. No one imagined that in 1993. Now, justice is a long arc. In Cambodia, we're prosecuting in the joint court between the United Nations and Cambodia, a hybrid court. We're prosecuting senior Khmer Rouge leaders who committed their crimes 40 years ago under the Pol Pot regime. They're in their 80s, and they're being prosecuted. Now, I don't think they ever dreamed they would be.
Ambassador Sheffer, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
David Sheffer is former U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues. His op-ed on the Nuremberg commemoration runs in the Los Angeles Times this weekend.
Coming up, the media ignore third-party candidates at our peril, so prepare to tunnel into Gary Johnson.
This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Wednesday was a bad day for Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson. When MSNBC's Chris Matthews asked him to name a foreign leader he respected, Johnson came up blank.
You got to do this anywhere, any continent. Canada, Mexico, Europe over there, Asia, South America, Africa, name a foreign leader that you respect.
I guess I'm having an Aleppo moment.
That's a reference to his other bad day earlier this month. When he was asked what he would do if elected about Aleppo, Johnson said,
"And what is Aleppo?"
Subsequently, speaking with journalist Mark Halperin, Johnson reflected on his failings.
Believe me, no one is taking this more seriously than me. I feel horrible.
What do you think will happen now?
Well, I have to get smarter.
And maybe we, the electorate, need to get smarter about Gary Johnson, who's currently polling at an average of 7% nationally. Cindy Simmons is a senior lecturer of journalism at Penn State, but back in 1997, she was a reporter in New Mexico, where Johnson was the governor, and she says there are some instructive stories about the Libertarian candidate that have not yet surfaced. Cindy, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks so much.
You and the governor have some history.
We do. I was a reporter for KUNM covering the state legislature, and Gary Johnson had recently been elected as an outsider Republican, so someone who had never really held office, but who was going to bring business sensibility to state government.
So one particular morning in February of 1997, you walk into the State House press room and...
there was pandemonium. Everyone had missed a major story. Gary Johnson's administration had given an exclusive to a TV station that there was a tunnel at the penitentiary of New Mexico and inmates were planning a major breakout.
Wow. That's not a story that you want to have missed. Was it something that would have been in your portfolio?
Of course, yes. prisons are particularly important in New Mexico because the penitentiary of New Mexico was the site of the second deadliest prison riot in U.S. history. Back in 1980, 33 men died. And since that time, the prison system had been under the very watchful eyes of the federal judiciary because conditions were so bad.
And at the time, there was sentiment among the Republicans in the legislature to privatize prisons.
Gary Johnson personally was pushing very, very hard to have New Mexico's prisons taken over by a private for-profit prison company. His favorite was Wackenhut.
So this was not only a big scoop, but it was also a great political opportunity for those trying to persuade New Mexicans that the current state-run prison system was corrupt and ineffectual.
It was put out as an example of just how very much the Union guards were not in control of the prison, that these inmates could tunnel out of the prison, but all was not as it seemed.
Because, as it turns out,
when the mainstream press, so that would have been the Albuquerque Tribune, the Albuquerque Journal, the Santa Fe New Mexican, and some other television stations, and myself, got on the story, what we found was that it wasn't exactly a tunnel with dirt lying on the floor where people had recently dug out. It turned out it was a utility conduit reinforced with wood, and it had been there for a very long time because there was rust on some of the nails, and wood found in the tunnel actually had termite trails visible in it.
How long did it take before it was certain that this story had no factual basis?
It started to unravel fairly quickly. By the Friday of that week, AFSCME, which represented the prison guards, debunked the idea that inmates had dug this tunnel. And then a state inquiry found that the tunnel had been there approximately 10 years and the Department of Corrections had paid to have it put in.
This guy's running for president. He has a history of, well, let's just say at a minimum, press manipulation. And that's relevant, and yet not a peep in the media.
And a lot of well-meaning people are interested in him. A lot of people don't like either of the major party candidates. And I think they see both Gary Johnson and Jill Stein as sort of clean. It's that special aura of the outsider. But Gary Johnson, at least, is not an outsider to government.
He's not going to be the president of the United States, but he may well, and Jill Stein as well, may influence the election. God knows we've cited the negatives for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump to a fairly well. Have we failed in our responsibility for not doing the same thing for these third-party candidates?
Yeah, we need to do this because he's the leading third-party candidate, and we shouldn't give him a free pass. There's more stuff like this out there, I think, if anybody digs. The question is, in the few weeks left before the election, where is your time best spent?
Cindy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cindy Simmons teaches journalism at Penn State University and is author of the forthcoming journalism novel, Wrong Kind of Paper. On last week's show, we covered the ongoing national prisoner strike. And during my conversation with editor of Prison Legal News, Paul Wright, something came up that, while it didn't make the final cut of our interview, really kind of jumped out at us.
There's this big trend nationally, and the Texas prison system, they've enacted rules that basically make it a disciplinary offense if a prisoner's family maintains a social media presence on their behalf.
Wait. What? We looked into this. And it's true. In April, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice quietly issued a new rule prohibiting inmates from social media activity, even if the accounts are maintained by a family member or other third party. This brings Texas into the company of South Carolina, New Mexico, and Maine, which have similar rules on the books curbing digital activity for prisoners. Meanwhile, Alabama has a law that makes it illegal for inmates to directly or indirectly participate in chat rooms, emails, forums, or yes, social media. Dave Moss is an investigative researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he's been on this.
You know, the evidence that prisons use to go after inmates is usually pretty thin. And to understand the judicial process, this doesn't go to a court. This goes to a panel of, you know, essentially prison guards who review whatever basic evidence there might be. That might be records they got from Facebook, and they'll draw conclusions from it without necessarily any expertise in how IP addresses work, on how Facebook logins work, but they'll draw conclusions anyways. And if they can go through communication logs from the inmate and see that the inmate had said something to the person on the outside that could be interpreted as collaborating on social media, then they might use that to go after an inmate. They will say things like, it's a violation of Facebook's terms of service for a third party to access an account on somebody else's behalf. And so then they'll use that as an excuse to get Facebook to remove inmates' accounts. It's not uncommon for prisons to go after inmates who've been engaged in political activity or who have, you know, talked back to a prison guard by finding whatever infraction they can twist to the circumstances in order to punish the inmate.
South Carolina has been particularly, let's just say, vigilant for social media activity. Can you give me a for instance of the kind of punishments they've meted out?
Sure. So it used to be that South Carolina would give you a level one offense for every day that you accessed Facebook. A level one offense that would include escapes, rapes, assaulting people, taking someone hostage, and then at the bottom, there's social media access. And we were seeing people getting in excess of 10 years in solitary. They did reduce that and put some limits on it, but, you know, as of this last week, you know, people are losing privileges for as much as a year. They're being put into disciplinary detention, which is solitary confinement, for 30 days, 60 days, losing telephone privileges. And what's kind of ironic about it is that people are trying to access social media so they can have more communication with the outside, and the response is to further limit people's ability to communicate, hence creating more of a black market for contraband cell phones and other ways to circumvent communication controls.
If only there were free speech advocacy organizations with staffs of lawyers who could go out and file lawsuits against authorities in cases like this to preserve the First Amendment.
Well, so far, groups like EFF and the ACLU have been digging into this. It's not quite at the stage where lawsuits have been filed. More, it's been filing Freedom of Information Act requests, fighting to get records to actually see what the situation is. And then in, say, cases like Texas, we have started communicating with Texas to actually get some clarity on what their policies are. Now, I'm not a lawyer myself. I'm a sort of muckraker for EFF. I dig into these things and use activism as a way to get policies changed. And we have had a lot of success in that regard. We were very, very successful in getting Facebook to move substantially in changing its process for taking down inmate social media pages. But, you know, the courts work, and the way that there have been rulings on how you can restrict inmates from speaking, it makes it very difficult to either bring a case and to win a case. I want to point out that when prisons censor inmate speech, it's not just censoring the inmate. It's censoring the ability for everyone on the outside to understand the criminal justice system from the perspective of the people who are most affected by it. It prevents us from understanding, you know, rats in cells, toilets overflowing, beatings that are going on in prisons, the overuse of pepper spray and solitary confinement. And these are things that are important to the national dialogue about over-incarceration. And so, you know, that is one of the main values of inmates, you know, whether legally or illegally getting information out of the prisons through contraband cell phones and through social media.
Dave, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me and covering this issue.
Dave Moss is an investigative researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Coming up, poverty is a hardy media perennial, but does it matter?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is brought to you by ZBiotics. Tired of wasting a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before? ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic is here to help. ZBiotics is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic, invented by scientists to feel like your normal self the morning after drinking. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol, which is responsible for rough mornings after. Go to ZBiotics.com/OTM to get 15% off your first order when you use OTM at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. That's ZBiotics.com/OTM and use the code OTM at checkout for 15% off.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's election season when candidates really get into the issues. For instance, Hillary Clinton recently wrote a New York Times editorial proposing low-income housing tax credits to keep roofs over the heads of the poor. Trump favors cutting taxes and regulations and denying teenage mothers public assistance unless, he wrote, they jump through some pretty small hoops. The fact is, the latest research suggests that we're making economic progress. The richest, of course, still get richer. The middle class is mending. Even the poor are edging up a little. But the very poorest, they are poorer now than ever. How can that be? Why is there more social mobility in Canada and France? America's the land of opportunity, right? It's a delusion, a founding myth. One of many we'll explore in the next few weeks, both the grand American myths and the queasy private presumptions we all hold, even if we're poor ourselves, about poor people. In the next few weeks, you'll hear many stories on our show, and one by one, they'll loosen the legs of the stool that props up our poverty myths. The conservative leg that blames social dysfunction and indolence, the liberal leg that decries government stinginess, and the third leg, the one we don't talk about.
Us. We need to have a frank conversation about the way that our lives directly contribute to poverty in America.
Matthew Desmond is a sociologist at Harvard and author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City.
I remember hearing a dear friend and mentor of mine, Ruth Lopez Turley, who's a sociologist at Rice University. She gave a presentation a few years ago and she said, if everyone who was zoned to Houston Public School District went to that school, Houston Public School District would have a 40% poverty rate. And then she asked the audience, do you know what the poverty rate is? It's 80%. And then she said, and then we have the audacity to ask why these schools are failing.
In his book, Desmond makes the abstract real, telling the stories of complicated and compelling individuals in rich detail. And in so doing, he reveals poverty, not as a realm where the other half lives, not even as a lack of money, but as a process, a complex social and financial interaction that strengthens the positions of the comfortable. He notes that the word exploitation has vanished from the debate and believes it should be reinstated.
Because it's a driver of poverty today. You know, poverty isn't just a product of joblessness. It isn't just a product of low wages. It's also a product of really high housing costs and for-profit colleges and predatory loan operations. And I think that we just have to be blunt and clear-eyed about the fact that some people are making a pretty dollar off the pockets of the poor. And I wonder, can we stop having a conversation about laziness or not? Can we stop that and really have a frank, honest conversation about why we are weird in the world for this level of poverty alongside this much wealth?
Conversations. How many have we had over the years on the causes of poverty? In 1795, founding father and political theorist Thomas Paine blamed civilization. He acknowledged that private property, though an unnatural construct, is the price we must pay for developing agriculture. But, he wrote,
it has dispossessed more than half the inhabitants of every nation of their natural inheritance, without providing, as ought to have been done, an indemnification for that loss, and has thereby created a species of poverty and wretchedness that did not exist before.
And so he proposed, not as a charity, but as a right,
to create a national fund out of which there shall be paid to every person, when arrived at the age of 21 years, the sum of £15 sterling as a compensation in part for the loss of his or her natural inheritance by the introduction of the system of landed property. And also, the sum of £10 per annum during life to every person now living of the age of 50 years and to all others as they shall arrive at that age.
For some reason, that didn't take. So we tell stories everlastingly to remind us of unfinished business. Here's what I learned doing the stories you'll hear in the next few weeks. Poverty means that you've slipped off the knife's edge, that a botched piece of paperwork or a bout of flu has cost you your job, then your home, and finally your kids. It means you sell your plasma for bus fare. It means you don't have the money to bury your mom. Most of us haven't a clue what it means to live like that, because most of us, even when the screws tighten and we gasp for breath, don't spiral down into a hell of loss upon loss. Because most of us have won the good luck lottery for a whole heap of reasons. Could be race or background or just being born in the right place. Research suggests that in Salt Lake City, you have roughly an 11% chance to rise from the bottom fifth income bracket to the top fifth. Whereas in Atlanta, you have a 4% chance, which means you don't really have a chance. But that said, if you're a reporter like me on the poverty tour, you don't go to Atlanta. You go to Ohio.
Well, right now we're heading out Route 50. In general, all this is part of the southeastern Ohio, Appalachian region.
Why Ohio? Well, I went because, like Neapolitan ice cream, you get the three main flavors of poverty in a single container. Appalachia for white, Cleveland for black, and manufacturing dead zones like Youngstown for the rust-colored variety.
We've always had a higher rate of poverty in the Appalachian areas because, you know, even at its peak, back at the turn of the last century, when we had coal mining jobs and jobs in timber, there were still more people than jobs. And
Jack Freck has spent his entire life battling to preserve aid to the poor, including 33 years as welfare director in an Appalachian county. Standing by his black SUV, he's gray-haired, bemused, verging on skeptical, and yet still game, despite having escorted countless reporters, like me, on the Appalachian leg of their poverty tour, past rusted trailers and shacks and a few creeks tinted a bright chemical yellow.
When they were setting up a coal mine somewhere, and they would throw up these wooden houses in a day. They'd either be, you know, four rooms in a box shape, or they had what they called shotgun houses that were maybe three rooms in a line. When I came here in the early 70s as a caseworker, there were hundreds and hundreds of those houses out there. Most of them had electricity at that point, but did not have running water.
You know, and he said all this before, some 30-odd years, the same tour, the same story.
In the last 20 years, the other thing that we've seen is families are doubling and tripling up in these old houses. Kids are sleeping on the floor or three or four to a bed.
He's trying to make the invisible visible.
Unless you have some reason to take a state road out to a county road and then a township road off the county road and a dirt road off another dirt road, you're not going to see them because that's where they are. And I think it lends itself to this whole idea that things aren't that bad.
And he definitely disposes of that idea because now you see. The hard part, he explains, as the day fades and we repair to his airy, well-appointed home nestled in the woods, the hard part isn't getting the media to see how bad it is. It's getting us to understand why, because we kind of think we already know.
You know, I think my first contact with the media in dealing with this really started back in the late 70s, around the time I took the job as a welfare director. And one of the things that you constantly deal with in this field is that people just, if you're not poor, it's not likely that you even know someone who's poor. And you certainly know very little about their lives. People deal in misperceptions and
stereotypes. Like what?
Well, I think the idea that poor people are lazy. There is no misperception about poor people that is greater. There needs to be a reason why are we unwilling to share with them. And the best way is to say they are poor through their own fault. We've gone so far in this country as to actually say that sharing with them hurts them. Giving them help creates dependency, which somehow we don't apply to Social Security, unemployment compensations, veterans benefits, tax breaks for mortgage payments, all the other things that everyone gets. I mean, Medicaid, which of course is welfare too. Almost everyone has to go on Medicaid. And yet no one looks down on them because they got old and had to go into a nursing home and could never possibly afford the cost to keep them there. So we're very specific about who we decide is on welfare and who isn't. And we overlook the fact that, you know, the average length of time of people on welfare is about 2 years. I mean, you know, again, it's all in the matter of the way we label things.
So you talked about this prevalent myth within the context of your first brush with the media. Tie yes. that together.
Well, I think for me, the way to advocate for poor people was to shine a light on them. To shine a light on them to show that this could happen to any of us. I think, though, that as time went on, I became much more aware of how much of this had to do with racism, how much of this had to do with sexism, how much of this had to do with other issues that had nothing to do with someone's ability or how hard they wanted to work or didn't want to work. I mean, you know, you can take almost the same stereotypes that we apply to poor people and get away with now. And you can see how for hundreds of years we applied those same stereotypes to black people.
So he worked with big media to undermine those stereotypes over and over again. We see the autographed pictures of network news stars, the snapshots and thank you notes scattered all over his house. Watching the videos of Jack's network appearances, you can literally see him age, each time a little grayer, a little stouter, but always the same passion. In 94 with Deborah Amos on ABC News Nightline.
People here are able to find shelter in all kind of places, and you know, garages and small campers and trailers and things like that. Similar places don't have running water. Some of them don't have electricity.
You might say that Jack Freck is an expert on welfare. The director of human services in Athens County, Ohio, the heart of Appalachia. He's been working with the poor.
In 95 with Chris Bury on Nightline.
Jack Freck, in charge of welfare for a poor Appalachian county in Ohio, says even less money will be available in times of recession when the welfare ranks inevitably grow.
I think it will have that desired effect. It will save money. It will be at the expense of poor people.
In 2006 on Good Morning America.
At this point in our county, there are almost no manufacturers left. The last three or four of them that offered, you know, relatively decent jobs with full benefits, they're all gone.
In 2010 with Ann Curry on NBC Dateline.
Athens County Welfare Director Jack Freck sees many young mothers like Crystal and says state and federal programs just don't help them enough.
Our staff work their butts off to get these people every dime they can. But at the end of the day, we send them out of here knowing that it's very likely that the last couple weeks of the month they're going to have to go to a food pantry to get enough food to eat.
You sound a bit angry about this.
I'm very angry about this.
Poor people.
Like poverty, anger comes in flavors. And here, Jax is tinged with a kind of smoldering heartache. But back in 93, on CBS's Eye to Eye with Connie Chung, the experience elicited something closer to outrage.
Listen to this. Soon, one of every three babies in America will be born to an unwed mother. The tragedy is, Two out of three families headed by single mothers live in poverty. It's a crisis that's pumping up the crime rate and choking the taxpayer.
The angle pursued in this segment was clearly shared by then-correspondent Bernard Goldberg, now conservative media critic and Fox News contributor. Here's Goldberg in the piece.
Connie, imagine an America with millions more poor people than we have now. You may not have to imagine long.
His piece featured author Charles Murray, ardent promoter of the idea that welfare leads to illegitimate children, which breeds more poverty and crime. That, in fact, the best course was to root out illegitimacy at its source.
There is a feeling that this plan to end welfare for single mothers is not just a half-baked crazy idea.
I think it's a dangerous, frightening prospect.
Jack Freck is in charge of the welfare system in Athens County.
We're justifying what essentially, in my mind, is an immoral decision by saying that we're doing this as a favor to them. Essentially, we would be taking millions and millions of dollars out of our poorest communities, and we would see people suffer greatly.
But if they suffered greatly, that's precisely the point. They might not have these kids.
Well, they might starve to death, too.
That was Jack's worst media experience. His best, never to be repeated, had occurred 9 years earlier in 1991, courtesy of ABC News.
Apparently, there was some concern by Peter Jennings and his producers that they were doing a considerable amount of coverage of the problems that Kurdish children were having as a result of the war. And there was this huge outpouring of people in this country wanting to help those people. They were concerned about this.
The crisis for Kurdish children simply reminded us that 12 million American children have a daily crisis as well, and that we should come and take a closer look at it.
Naturally, they chose Ohio.
Our unusual concentration on children in poverty is going to last a couple of weeks. This week here in Ohio, because all the statistics and many of the situations match the rest of the country.
And naturally, they called Jack Freck.
Peter Jennings came down, and you know, him and I spent the day. We went out and walked around. They shot a video of poor families, interviewed lots of people. They had correspondents in three or four locations in Ohio. And then throughout the week, it would lead the newscast, and it would be something that happened that day.
When you get close to the poor, you recognize right away that very often the level of assistance which they get from government doesn't even lift them up to the legal poverty line, let alone above it. Which seems to say that your congressmen and your state legislators have failed to recognize that children and families in poverty are a national disaster. In your name, they often argue about other priorities and welfare cheats. 12 million American children who cheat.
The overwhelming response they got was that we don't believe this. The pictures you're showing us of these poor families and how they're living, we don't believe this is happening in America. And we're horrified. So that was, you know, their attempt to shine a light on this. I mean, this was not all sweetness and light. And I mean, they showed a drug-addicted mom over, I think, in Dayton someplace. Her baby was in an incubator. They had, you know, some poor kid up in Columbus, a 10-year-old boy, and he was taking responsibility for his siblings. And, you know, it was, I thought, excellent reporting about what was happening. You know, you're convinced that if people only saw this, if they only knew, it would make a difference. So you can imagine my perspective on this when, you know, Peter Jennings, hearing him do a broadcast every night, literally saying the words that I had told him earlier that day about, you know, what benefits are, what problems are, what struggles are. You know, here's the most, you know, famous, renowned newscaster at the time.
And a huge audience.
Huge audience.
You must have thought, this is the moment.
Yes, absolutely. And I was thrilled. I was 42 years old, and I thought, that's it. We're done here. You know, we've solved poverty.
And then?
And then nothing. Nothing.
Actually, a report released around that time by Senator Jay Rockefeller did spur legislation on child health insurance. But there was no effort to halt the decline in cash assistance to poor families in Ohio and elsewhere. Not then, and certainly not now.
It's gone in the other direction. People are less sympathetic. They're harsher now. I mean, you know, you will see folks now, you know, begin to also rail against welfare, even though there's hardly anyone left on welfare. In Ohio, 75% of the cash assistance welfare cases are child-only cases. There's only 15,000 adults left on cash assistance in Ohio. You know, we have eliminated cash assistance. You know, we don't have these kids living in orphanages. We have them living with grandma instead because the families have fallen apart and we no longer support families that stay together. So the conservatives have won the day. They've won, and we're still not happy about it. We still don't give them credit even when they go out and work. You know, they have to work off their benefits. They do. We still don't give them credit for it. We still think they're awful and terrible. So, you know, that's what I've seen evolve over all of this. And that's how I've kind of seen the media reaction to this, or non-reaction at this point. There is some renewed attention now because of the 20th anniversary of welfare reform. I've had a lot of contact with folks lately. People call me up, background information, whatever. Yes. Well, I mean, you know, let's just put it on the table. I have absolutely no expectations whatsoever that this will move the needle one iota for a change, no matter how much coverage we get of this. I'm not unrealistic about that, you know, but I also know this. When Jennings and these folks did it, no one, I think, could have done it better. But what they didn't understand is they were up against a population out there who did not want to hear this, who did not want to change their minds about poor people. So no amount of information they were giving them, no amount of cajoling, no amount of this is the logical, the right thing to do, busting the myths, all that kind of stuff. None of that was going to matter when basically you had a population that wanted to cling to those things because it justified them not sharing.
This is the first of a five-part series, and I'm a little nervous, because when the people I met in Ohio tell you their stories in the next few weeks, how will you respond? With empathy? Maybe that's not such a good idea.
If what you mean by empathic is caring and kind and understanding, absolutely. But if what you mean by empathic is they should put themselves into our shoes, they should feel what we feel, definitely not. This sort of empathic engagement leads to burnout. It leads to suffering and pain.
Paul Bloom, Yale Professor of Psychology and Cognitive Science at last year's Aspen Ideas Festival.
There's a wonderful collaboration between Tanya Singer, a neuroscientist, and Matthew Ricard, a Buddhist monk and biologist, where they train people to feel empathy, to engage in empathic contact with other people. Then they trained another group to be compassionate, to care about other people, but not necessarily engage in the same way. What they found was the empathic group, they suffered more and they helped less. The compassionate group felt good and they helped more. So if you took away empathy, what would you replace it with? A sort of rather cold-blooded rational cost-benefit analysis. Go not after what gives you the buzz, but what really helps other people. And then the second thing is we need some sort of emotional push. But the push need not come from empathy. The push can come from love, from caring, from compassion, for more distanced emotions that don't swallow us up in the suffering of others.
So how to tell the story? The playwright Bertolt Brecht soundly rejected empathy. When he depicted injustice, he did not want us to say, "Yes, I felt like that too. It's only natural. It'll never change. The sufferings of this man appall me because they are inescapable." No. Brecht worked willfully to undermine our empathetic tears so we could see more clearly. So instead we'd say, "That's not right. That's unbelievable. It's got to stop. The sufferings of this man appall me because they are unnecessary." As for me, I just figure if Jack Freck is still trying to shine a light, just because, and you listen, just because, and if, as Matthew Desmond argues in Evicted, the inhuman trap that is poverty is not so great as it once was, then maybe sustaining our gaze does work, if we can discern that what is appalling is, in fact, unnecessary. Next week, we dissect the notion that success in life hinges on personal responsibility, the work ethic, and all that.
I want to erase the stigma of welfare for good by restoring a simple, dignified principle.
Bill Clinton's Welfare Reform Act, aka the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act, changed the landscape of poverty in America.
No one who can work can stay on welfare forever.
We peel back the myths that have long shaped policy decisions about welfare and our assumptions about who deserves it.
These fears about welfare really sapping people of their initiative and creating a permanent dependent class, welfare and America just have never gone together.
We hear from a young Cleveland mother driven to sell her own plasma when caring for her severely premature baby cost her her job.
To have a needle in you, sucking the blood out of you, and then taking the nutrients and then pushing blood back into you and repeating the cycle is very uncomfortable. But feeling sad and feeling sorry for myself is not going to help the situation, is it? Does it upset me? Yeah, it upsets me, it frustrates me, but I am that person that takes responsibility for their actions.
Why often the work ethic just doesn't work on next week's On the Media.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Paige Cowett, Michael Loewinger, and Sara Kari. We had more help from Leia Fetter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Busted, America's Poverty Myths, is produced by Mira Sharma and Eve Claxton, with special thanks to Nina Chowdhury. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. The series is produced in collaboration with WNET in New York as part of Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America. NET made a short film of me on the poverty tour with Jack Freck. You can check it out at our website, onthemedia.org. Major funding for Chasing the Dream is provided by the JPB Foundation, with additional funding from the Ford Foundation. Jim Schachter is WNYC's Vice President for News. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.